My name is Daisha Clay. I'm the audio librarian here at Classical 91.7. While I'm a real librarian, I have a deep, dark
secret.
I know very little about classical music. I grew up listening to rock. And I know something about jazz. But when it comes to classical, the thing is, I want to learn. And as it turns out, I work with people who know a lot about classical music. Every week on this show, one of my coworkers will give me a homework assignment, a piece of classical music they think I should know, and then we'll discuss it. Come learn with me in the classical classroom. Hello and welcome to the Classical Classroom. I'm Daisha Clay, and today my teacher will be Keith Weber, who is currently the director of music and an organist at the Salem Evangelical Lutheran Church in Houston, and is the artistic director of Grace Song Incorporated.
That's right.
So before we get started on the music, could you give us a sort of Reader's Digest condensed version of your story?
Well, I'd like to crib a phrase from Nicholas Slaninsky, the famous dictionary writer and Russian conductor who called himself a failed wunderkind conductor. I was a celebrated teenage organist, and so I am a failed wunderkind organist. And it's been really great that had never worked out, because life has been so much more interesting. After I finished my undergrad degree, I was turned down, actually, for graduate study at Eastman, which was a big shock. But, in fact, it resulted in me not leaving music, but professionally having a banking career, during which time I became active in singing and opera and that sort of thing.
So you were turned down from school.
Until years later, until post-banking, that the organist at the Riverside Church, a guy named John Walker, was giving me free lessons. And he insisted that I enter the AGO National Contest. Well, I did, and I got in the finals and all that sort of thing. And the Eastman professor walks up to me after the finals, and he says, "Why didn't you come to Eastman?" And I said, "Well, you turned me down." And he said, "That's not possible." And he went back and pulled the file. Turns out they sent the wrong letter.
It was
an actual clerical thing.
So what was your reaction to that?
Well, at least I knew. Mm-hmm. I mean, that actually made some sense.
And did that change the course of what you were doing professionally?
Sure. That, as well as when I became a banker in order to get the bills paid, I was part of a group that started an opera company in Dallas. And so for 10 years, we did a summer season. And so that played into it as much as everything that happens in life happens for a reason. And so, I still love the organ. I adore it. I adore its literature. It's the core of me. But, boy, it's been interesting to move into other areas. So I've come around full circle, actually, into playing the organ more recently than I have in a long time. And then I've also have my own private coaching practice. I work with working singers.
Yeah, your credentials were so long that I decided not to read all of them out.
What if you live long enough? You have a nice bio. It's nice to be old.
Well, the organ aspect of what you do brings us to the piece that we're going to be talking about today, which I'll let you introduce because my French is abysmal.
Oh, well, it's called the Organ Symphony. It's the third symphony of Camille Saint-Saëns. Okay. Which is a guy whose name we used to love to say because it was Saint-Saëns, and you could say Saint-Saëns.
Why don't we hear a little bit of that before we get talking about it? Let's start with the first movement just to get a taste of it.
Great.
Thank you. So this first movement was sort of interesting to me for a couple of reasons.
Yes.
First, because, and I hope you don't take offense to this, because I am completely ignorant of classical music, but it was interesting to me because it was not at all interesting to me. It didn't strike me on a visceral level. It sort of sounded to me like if you looked up classical music in an interactive dictionary, this is the sort of thing that would play. And I found that as I listened to it, it brought up a lot of questions like what is this music? Where did this composer come from? Where do these sounds come from? Why this? It just was a complete sort of vacuum for me, especially not having, I sort of decided not to look into who the composer was prior to our lesson because I wanted to come in fresh and learn all about it.
That's wonderful.
So that to me was my take on the first movement.
Uh-huh.
Feel free to inform me.
Well, this is, you know, late 1880s, and this guy, Camille Saint-Saëns, was a well-regarded composer, but he had a variety of background. He was an organist, a pianist as well. He was played professionally. Orchestral conductor, teacher, you know, friend of all the really major people in Europe at the time. And this is at the very height of he enjoyed some popularity in his lifetime. And so when he set out to write this piece, I think he had a sense that it was an opportunity to tie everything together. And I think he did. You know, late 19th century, the music's all about the spirit of the outdoors, I suppose, and this kind of the seeming randomness and direct emotional connection that you get standing on a mountainside watching trees and the glory and the spaciousness of thing and how grand it feels as a human being to take all of that in.
Yeah.
And he's part and parcel of that whole movement that sought to write down what that feels like.
And who were his musical contemporaries?
Oh, gosh. All those late Parisian, the organists like Marcel Dupré and Fauré and Berlioz. His contemporaries were fellow romantics who had big hearts that they liked to wear on their sleeve. And they had a love for grandiose poetry and for things writ large. You know, across the thingy, you know, Wagner was writing at this time. You know, that whole kind of letting the music itself without any kind of text tell a story, actually paint a picture for you without the benefit of any words. So they called this program music, where you would let the construction of the piece be a story without any words. And so that's when I get at this first movement. I see all sorts of soundscapes, I'll call them, which equate directly to stuff that I would see.
Okay.
Yeah.
I can see that. I definitely, the sort of, I want to say expansive, but I feel like I use that word a lot. But that's really, it's scenic. It's very,
right. That's right.
You know.
That's exactly right. What a great word. It's also just like the outdoors, the wind will come up at any moment. It's also very temporal, and things change immediately.
Yes, I noticed that. A lot of fluctuations.
Right. And that's part and parcel also of the romantic compositional spirit, is this, kind of liquid and quicksilver and kind of, it's this and that and that, and it's all this together.
Just listening.
Yeah. Oh, here we go. It's very dramatic stuff.
It is very dramatic.
And it is very freewheeling emotional.
It's very sweeping.
And it's a virtuoso orchestra literature.
You were really specific, by the way, about recording you wanted me to listen to.
Absolutely.
And why this recording?
Well, it's from one of the golden ages of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, was the tenure of Daniel Barenboim as a conductor. Now, the Chicago Symphony, and it's actually pretty timely because one of the things I love about this recording is the sonic play between the organ, the sound of the organ itself, and the sound of the brass section. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, organs have their own brass section. Mm-hmm. They're called reeds. It's the snarly sound that you hear in an organ sound. Well, just recently, a man, the former principal trumpeter of the Chicago Symphony, and the man responsible for the sound of that whole section, top to bottom, all the horns and the trombones and the trumpets, just, his name was Adolf, or otherwise known as Bud Herseth, and he played for 50 years in the same orchestra, and he created a sound like no one ever, what anyone ever had. And when they put this recording together, it was right in the heyday of this, and the sound of the brass section is just unmistakable.
Yeah.
Yeah, if I had not known the recording and you played it for me and I heard one note, one chord, I could tell you.
Wow.
Now the orchestra was.
That's interesting because that you bring up the organ, because in this first movement, I was sort of going, okay, why is this called an organ symphony? I can't hear any organ anywhere.
Well, it's like a lot of appellations, a lot of names are attached to a piece afterwards that kind of fail as descriptors. This is not actually an organ symphony. It's just a symphony that later has a really kind of striking spot for the organ.
Well, we don't want to ruin, for the listeners. We don't want to spoil it.
Right.
But let's hear a little bit of the second movement, which, so the first movement is about 20 minutes long, and I'm sort of just listening to it going, okay, this is nice. And then we get to the second movement, and all of a sudden it's like, what is this weirdness?
Yeah. It's very strong.
Yeah. It's like all of a sudden it's alive.
Da-da-da. Right. And it's extremely well played.
This sort of, for lack of a vocabulary, I'll call it the chorus, this sort of strain that's repeated.
Right.
I don't know if Bjork is a classical music fan, but there is a song by her on her album Post called Isabel.
Yeah.
That part right there.
Right.
It's a direct ripoff.
Yeah, well, I love those connections. You know, there's all sorts of ways that modern music and pop music in particular inform and echo classical things. I think it's important to find out what's in common.
Yeah.
Not what is different about something. Now, what's cool about this movement is that the piano starts to enter the picture. And, you know, it's for piano four hands. So it sounds like the pianist has 20 fingers. Well, they do. It's two people.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah. And his writing, you know, and pianist conductors write better piano parts than... Because they know what's up.
There it is.
There it is. Yeah.
I also noticed the production on this recording is really something.
Yeah.
It just, you hear it on one side and you've got the orchestra on the other.
That's right. It's just warm and clear. The whole recording is very, very present.
Mm-hmm.
Like you're sitting right in the middle of the orchestra.
It seems, this movement seems so much more, I don't know what to call it, but it seems much more sort of awake and alive than the first movement is so sleepy, and this in contrast is so strong.
It's full of life, yes.
Do you know anything about sort of the theme behind what the composer was working on? Why this movement is so different from the first, where this was
Well, you know, the Yeah, in symphonic literature, people, I think, put a whole way, in fact, way too much credence in the fact that all of these movements connect somehow and that they contrast and that you should hear them without interruption of applause. Well, you know, in a Beethoven symphony, if you didn't applaud each and every moment, he would have gone home and blew his brains out and got drunk and gone crazy. Because there are traditionally three or four movements and the middle movement tends to be slow and there's all sorts of conventions. Generally speaking, in the Romantic Symphony, each movement is a self-contained thing.
Okay.
Yeah. And in fact, when Beethoven premiered his Ninth Symphony, for example, he stuck two movements of another piece in between the second and third movement at the premiere.
What?
Yeah, sure. There's nothing sacrosanct
so
about
it's,
movement order, for heaven's sake.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So that is really interesting to me.
Yeah.
I assume that, you know, you've got a symphony, and within
right.
that symphony, you've got, you know, various movements, and those movements
right.
are linked together in some fashion. They're telling maybe a story, or they've got some sort of some sort of commonality.
Yeah, yeah. And there are many people who do that.
Yeah.
And there are many, many examples of that.
Yeah.
But there are just as many examples mm-hmm. where there isn't.
So it's kind of like an album. Like
correct.
You've got a lot of albums where you do have a theme. For example, one Arcade Fire's Neon Bible, and that album very much has a theme. Every song
uh-huh.
has a sort of religious theme, so
right.
it's really
right.
interesting. But then they and other groups have albums where these songs are completely disparate,
uh-huh.
not necessarily. They don't sound like each other.
Right.
No common theme whatsoever.
Right.
So there are composers that approach a symphony in that way.
That's correct.
Where it's an album.
Right. And that's one of the interesting things about classical music. From early on in the Baroque dance suite,
yeah.
which has movements that maybe they're in the same key or related keys, but the dances don't have anything to do with each other.
Hmm.
The whole album concept
yeah.
has been
yeah.
around for a long time.
Huh.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And whether or not there's connective tissue or not is part of the design of the album. Yeah, it's been that way forever.
You've blown my mind. My mind is blown.
Yay.
That's good.
We like that.
Well, let's hear a little bit of the third movement, which is the most interesting
yes.
of these to me. It just blows you out of the water.
And let me set this up. One of the reasons this was so great, back in the 80s, now this has all changed in the last 20 years, but in the 80s, there really weren't any nice organs in concert halls. Now, as big donors needed a way to express themselves, we now have great big pipe organs in concert halls all over America. In Dallas, for example, there's this phenomenal instrument in the symphony orchestra space. Well, it's always been a problem because the quality, or you're kind of stuck with what you've got. And when you play this piece and you use an electronic organ, it just doesn't sound right. So by the magic of audio technology, I think that they must have done the orchestra part first, but the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, the legendary group, of course. They went to Chartres Cathedral
mm-hmm.
outside of Paris, and where there is a 19th century, now it's gone through a number of revisions, this organ, but the core of it is a late 19th century French organ, and it has a very particular sound, fiery and bold and aggressive and... So here is a way that perhaps in Saint-Saëns' own imagination, this piece should have sounded,
uh-huh.
was the sound of the organ that he was used to,
mm-hmm.
combined with this beautiful big orchestra. And so it's just so refreshing of all the recordings of this piece to start with this French organ sound, which has fire at the top, fire at the bottom, and just snarl everywhere. And the organist, I think, is Gaston Letez, interesting player. Although, you know, what we organists love about the Saint-Saëns organ symphony is that it's a brain it's a brain dead gig because the part is not hard at all. You get billing on the program as a soloist and it's something you can sort of sight read and you get paid anyway.
That's awesome. That's great.
That's nice.
Let's hear what this guy does.
Listen to that sound. Oh, for heaven's sake. And then aggressive and beautiful playing, and wow.
It's like you suddenly understand in this third movement why it's called the Oregon Symphony.
That's a whole sonic world, the organ. And the symphony, it tries to imitate what the organ has been for centuries. This combination of choruses, top to bottom. Listen to the penis. And then... that's a great piece of work, this record.
Wow.
No.
That is...
yeah.
I'm really glad that you told me that it was piano for four hands.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's ecstatic. Listen to the... now, here's the brass. That's Chicago.
Wow.
Yeah, that's Bud Herseth's signature section sound. Ready? Mm-hmm. And it's just... mm. It's the wall. And the combination of those two.
Uh-huh. And yeah, you would not want to meet them in a dark alley.
Oh, my. And wall. It just makes your blood boil.
That's great.
Like all good organists, here comes the fugue. Which is the one voice enters and the next voice, and then here's the third one. They're all playing the same thing in a kind of a... yeah, any organist worth his salt has a plays a fugue at some point.
Mm.
And he uses every trick in the book at maintaining the excitement level.
Uh-huh.
Changing keys, slipping another material, combining material.
Yeah.
And here's the pastoral bit. With, of course, the well-known Chicago Symphony soloist of the time. There's the boss and the flute players. The thing I love is a little bit later, Barenboim gets the acceleration at the end of the movement, gets it right on the money.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to do. And then, of course, at the very end of this, you'll hear a scale, an organ scale, down to low C, which is as much as we get. It's as low as it's the lowest note on the instrument. And here comes the fugue again. Oh. See? And then level one. Here comes a little tune. It's just so polished and unified and fiery. And then... winds and strings batting it around. And trumpet. Or horn, rather, sorry. And organ. Now, brass.
You guys can't see this, but the entire time Keith has been air conducting to this piece.
Yeah, you bet.
I don't think I've done a classical classroom with somebody who is as excited about the music as you are.
Oh, well, that's what I am. Here comes the second pastoral section. One of the things I love, the horn player, his name's Dale Clevenger, he's now retired, but here he goes. And It's one of the hundreds of little details.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And then this is the last, the little calm before the storm. And the buildup is about to begin for the last time. We're starting with that. Mm-hmm. And then level one. And it's like a pot boiling.
Right.
You turn up the fire a little bit, there's level two. And an old trick. It's where you make the note values longer. You take the material from before and swing it a little bit and syncopate it and make it longer.
The organ is killing me.
Yeah. And then you're ready. Here we go. Hang on. Ladies and gentlemen, fasten your seatbelts.
I'm holding on.
Here we go. Stay chilling on them. Puts the brakes on. It's like, no!
Don't slow down.
Yeah. And here comes the scale. Ready? Down. And then D and C.
There is so much going on in that piece of music. You kind of were showing me that visually as we were listening.
Yeah. It's immensely satisfying, the end of that movement.
Yeah.
It just gathers and gathers and gathers and then just sits there and is this kind of sonic, I don't know, completion. It's just, oh.
Well, and I love it as the culmination of the symphony. It reminds me of the Arcade Fire piece. I talked about their album Neon Bible, and the organ in this enters in the same way that that it does in this piece.
Right.
The song before it is very, very quiet and slow, and then. So. Right?
Exactly.
Yeah, and that's right after this lull in the album, which is, you know, it's sort of a concept album.
Right. Very same thing. That's great.
And then it just really takes you there. It sort of explodes.
Yeah.
I love that sound. I've never heard organ like in the piece that you shared with me today, in the organ symphony. That was just amazing. Well, Keith, thank you so much being here
you're
today.
You're just so welcome.
This has been so much
fun.
I
loved it again. Thank you.
Yeah, let's do it again. And everybody, thanks for listening to The Classical Classroom. We'll catch you next time.
Bye-bye. You're still a soldier in your mind. Still nothing's on the line. It's money that we need, as if we're only mouths to feed. I know no matter what you say, there's some debts you'll never pay. Working for the church while your family